Thanks very much, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. It was mentioned I'm chair of the National Affordable Housing Summit. That's a coalition which was established about 4 years ago. Not by me, I'm just the independent chair of it, but it consists principally of the Housing Industry Association and the ACTU and ACOS from the welfare sector and Shelter and the Community Housing Federation of Australia. But it's also involved a lot of other people from the business and community sectors. Much of what I say today will have come from the thinking and discussions of that group, and nearly all of it I think will either be reflecting what the group thinks or compatible with what the group thinks, but there's one section where I'll very much divert from the party line, and I'll identify that when I come to it. I want to say a little bit about, firstly, about what I see as the context in which we need to try and address problems of affordable housing, and then look at what I think are two shortish term priorities, by which I mean things that could start to bite and achieve some benefits in the shortish term, and then some longer term priorities which really couldn't bite for perhaps even a couple of decades or more, but I think are crucial. The fact that they're long-term in that sense doesn't mean we shouldn't get cracking on them as soon as we can. That's a very important distinction to make, I think, as to when you need to start taking some action and when you might be able to start expecting some benefits from it. Firstly, in relation to the context, I'm not going to say a whole lot because I think we've had some very useful presentations earlier today, and I don't think there was any element of them with which I would want to take issue. In relation to price and rent trends that were identified, I'd agree with what was said. I would just want to highlight the fact that I think it was said by some and probably endorsed by others that rent is where the situation is most likely to deteriorate more substantially in the foreseeable future. And that's one of the reasons that I'll come to later as to why I think we should especially focus on rental issues in the near future. In relation to the overall rental supply, I just want to add one other element to the picture that's been described earlier, and that is that if you look at public housing as a proportion of overall dwellings in Australia, then the contribution that it makes to that task of providing enough dwellings for Australians has fallen very substantially over the last decade or so. We now have 100,000 less public housing dwellings than we would have if it were the same proportion of our overall dwellings as it was 10 years ago, if it was still making the same contribution to the task. So when you look at, from the figures that David Gruen showed, there, you know, perhaps about 500,000 lower-income households, or very low-income households, in housing stress, and in one sense 100,000 of them, you could say, are due to the contraction in our public housing over that period. In relation to households in unaffordable housing, I think it is important to focus mainly on the lower two quintiles, the bottom 40% or so, and I think the figures that I would have used are very similar to David Gruen's and suggest, and the Minister I think said the same thing, that we're looking at well over 750,000 households in unaffordable housing amongst the bottom 40% of the community, and it goes over 1 million when you include the sort of middle part of the income scale. But I think there are probably about as many again who are what I call the hidden victims of high housing costs. And they've been referred to actually a little bit recently. The Minister referred to them. These are the people who've only kept themselves below the sort of statistical cut-off point of 30% of your housing costs by living in poor quality housing or a long way away from where their jobs are, or if they don't have jobs, their job opportunities, and or where their families are. And many of them are greater victims, actually, of housing costs than some people who might be just above the 30% proportion of their income being paid on housing costs. So if anyone says to you, or you wonder to yourself, look, in those figures of 750,000 or 1 million who are paying above 30%, some of them are discretionary, they didn't really need to be. Sure, some of them will be. But there are also a hell of a lot of others who are not shown by those figures who are major housing cost victims, paying big money and spending a lot of time and incurring a lot of stress in their lives and in their families' lives because they've had to live so far away from where they work. It's also important, I think, to bear in mind the extent to which excessive investment in housing, by which I mean excessive relative to the dwellings that we get for it, which is the principal issue, damages our debt and trade outcomes. There are a number of big macroeconomic impacts of the problems in the housing market. The Minister mentioned some of them, but it's also led substantially to the fact that we're about the most heavily indebted country of all the developed countries now. The US can beat us, but no one else. And our level of household debt has deteriorated appallingly in the last 10 years, very largely contributed to by excessive borrowing for excessive house prices. And it also diverts a lot of our resources away from things which would improve our imports and exports with too much investment. Again, too much relative to what we get for it anyway, going into housing because of the inflated prices. There's been some reference to the question of size of housing and whether or not we're now having rather grandiose expectations of what size of housing we could expect. I'm actually a bit puritanical on that. I don't greatly like a lot of these big houses, partly actually because of the damage to the environment they often cause by the massive air conditioning costs and other sorts of things aggravated by their design. But I think it's relevant to bear in mind that the data shows, and David Gruen's figures also showed this, that the cost of construction and the size of housing are a very small part of the picture. That isn't a major contributor to the issue. But also it's very important for us when thinking about sizes of housing not to fight the last war. I've been pointing out for a while, and I think some of the comments made earlier tend to endorse this, that the focus that we've had for the last 10 or 15 years, with people saying rightly that the number of sole person households is increasing hugely and that our stock is not appropriately profiled to deal with that, that's undoubtedly true. But there is a danger of overshooting in that respect. We have responded to it very substantially, and of course the pipeline is sometimes 10 years longer or more in terms of our dwelling profile. And I think there's a risk of overshooting towards the one-person household size. I think we're going to get much more shared housing for a variety of reasons. It's not just the Gen Y staying at home problem. It's a lot of other things as well. It's happening right now, frankly. Often the anecdotes and the case studies tell you 3 or 4 years before what your macro data base analysis tells you. And I think it's happening right now that people, and will continue to happen, that we will need more shared housing of one kind or another. I don't mean the kind of housing where you share the dirty dishes and your clothing with each other, not the sort of student situation. That may happen a bit, but other forms of housing where you're sharing the property but with a somewhat greater degree of privacy. And that has some implications for, depending on how you define the size of the dwelling, has some implications for what we need to be thinking about. Finally, I think it's very important to bear in mind the impact of changes in the labour market on the nature of demand for housing. And this is crucially related to the point that was made earlier about the blowout in the prices of well-located housing. That's partly because we're hugely affected by changes in the labour market, and particularly through women's entry into the paid workforce. There's often a reluctance to look at the very profound impacts of that because some people fear it may lead to a backlash. I think that's very misguided. We must be clear-eyed about this and recognise it's brought about huge changes, that it's greatly in the housing context, it's greatly increased the demand for well-located housing, and it's also increased the ability of some households to meet that demand because they now have two incomes rather than one. But of course their need for well-located housing is increased by the fact they now have two jobs. They also have the much more complicated transport tasks of the day than they had before. When there was one earner in the household, usually male, working in the same job for 40 years before getting the gold watch, the question of whether to buy a house and where to buy it was pretty simple. And the transport tasks involved for that household during a normal day were pretty simple. By and large, the male getting to the predictable workforce and back. They're now enormously different, with all the different side trips that need to be made and the anxieties that are attendant on those side trips very often. And one of the consequences of that is that now it's much more important for those who can afford it to be located in exactly the right place for their jobs, and hence the increasing demand on the well-located housing and the gentrification that's occurred. So I think we need to bear that in mind very much. But one thing I think it will lead to is a lot more what I call discretionary rental. There will be people who have to rent because they can't afford anything else. But I think a long-term and probably not reverse trend will be towards more discretionary rental. There will be a larger number of households for whom it's an entirely rational decision to decide not to buy because of the much greater job mobility, whether voluntary or involuntary, of the future, job mobility for at least one of the partners, if not both, and therefore the risk that a particular location for a house will not in fact be good for the long term, the much greater, if I can put it this way, relationship mobility, again, whether voluntary or involuntary, and the reduced certainty over time of major capital gains on a regular basis, and therefore the risk of being caught needing to move for reasons to do with job changes or relationship changes, but not being able to move because the market is adverse. So I think we're going to find a lot more discretionary rental, and that will also lead to a desire for longer term leasing. Well, let me move on then quickly to the short-term priorities and the long-term priorities. The short-term priorities focus very much on affordable rental. And I suggest that we focus on rental firstly because it's been mentioned before. That's where the lower income people who are meeting unaffordable housing costs are overwhelmingly to be found in rental. So I think that's one reason. A second reason is that it's where I think the deterioration is going to be greatest for the next 5 years at least, as I think Rob Mellor said amongst others. A third reason is that I think we have a better prospect of achieving significant improvements in that area at a modest public cost in a reasonably short period with little, if any, risk of making things worse. Whereas I think on the home purchase side, there are a number of things, attempts at quick fix, which could make things substantially worse. But finally, this sort of battle that you often find between those who are in favour of rent and those who are in favour of purchase, I find really a pretty, at best, futile and misguided dichotomy. After all, just to illustrate it now, a lot of the problems in the rental area, a lot of the shortage of vacancies and growth in rent is caused by the problems we're having in the purchase area. If we were able to make it easier to purchase, we wouldn't have as much pressure on the rental market and those who want to rent would be better off. Conversely, if we can bring down rents, we make it easier for people to save to be able to buy. So these two goals should not be seen as at war with each other. They're complementary if properly pursued. I think there are two things in focusing on affordable rent that we need to look at. The first is direct public investment and the second is assisted private investment. In relation to direct public investment, some of these issues have been talked about, but the new National Affordable Housing Agreement, which will be essentially finalised in the next couple of months, is an absolutely once-in-a-generation crucial opportunity to get not only the structure of all this assistance much better than in the past, but also, having got the structure right, to then put more money into it. And when I say put more, it may mean no more than actually just restoring the level we used to have 10 or 15 years ago. We've slashed spending in this area. Some of that slashing of spending has aggravated the weaknesses in the system which people now criticise. If we can get the structure right and the product right, if I can put it that way, which I think we can, then we must put more money back into the public and also the non-profit housing system. I wouldn't have too much rigidity about whether it's public or non-profit, but the key elements of it are that the housing be reasonably affordable, related to the income perhaps of the people in it, and that the housing be sustained on that basis for a very long period. But we do need to put more money into that. We also need to be much more transparent in the way in which we fund the housing. Many of the problems in that area have come from a failure to distinguish between money that's for operating costs of the housing and money that is for growth in the housing and will only be continued if the additional housing is achieved on the ground. So we need a very clear distinction in future, I think, between money for operating costs from the governments, Commonwealth or state or both, and growth funding with specific targets for that, with the funding being conditional upon achieving those growth targets. And that will be a vital part of the National Affordable Housing Agreement. The summit group is thinking at the moment of the order of, say, 120,000 more dwellings in what we call, as a sort of working title, registered housing. This includes public housing, community housing, other non-profit housing, housing provided under the new National Rental Affordability Scheme, and some low-cost home purchase under home purchase assistance programs. All those groups we think should be lumped together in terms of a national target, not too much rigidity about exactly how you achieve it, scope for different state approaches to this, but adoption of a clear national target and of a clear Commonwealth commitment of resources to that, conditional upon achievement of those targets. But if you aim, for example, at reducing by half over the next 12-odd years, reducing by half the proportion of low and moderate income households who are in unaffordable rent, you're looking at about 750,000 extra dwellings that are affordable for and are occupied by people in that household. It's a big ask. If the registered housing part of the picture is to contribute to that, it needs to be at least of the order of 120,000 over the next, say, for 2015, and then more beyond that. That would amount, in effect, to about 10% of all additional stock each year being of this sort of category. Now, there was a question before about whether we should have growth targets. I think it's crucial that we do at the national level, and with that puts some constraints and some opportunities on the states, and then they work out the detail after that. But as a corollary to the direct public investment in government and non-profit housing, the National Rental Affordability Scheme that the Minister and others have referred to provides what I've been calling assisted private investment. No matter how keen one is on public housing or non-profit housing that's fully funded by the government, and no matter how committed to supporting it a government is, the size of this task is so huge it cannot possibly be met by fully funded public or non-profit housing. We must get substantial tranches on a sustainable basis of private investment into this area. And we need to do it, I think, in ways which not only are affordable to the public purse, but also, firstly, don't inflate rents, and secondly, provide dwellings that are occupied by lower-income households. Because a huge problem at the moment, as mentioned earlier, is a lot of the low-rent housing is not occupied by low-income households. And that problem is getting worse as the queues and the auctions for rental housing build up and the prospect of the low-rent housing going to the higher-income households increases. And that's what the NRAS, as it's called now, aims to do in the way that's been described earlier, and I won't go over that again. But that is a program that will take a significant time to build, as it has in the United States. There are some similarities between that and what's been adopted here. It really starts to bite, I think, personally, in a sort of macro sense, in the 10 to 20 year period from now. This is a problem that's taken a long time to develop, and if we fool ourselves it can be solved quickly, we'll come up with a lot of things that are badly designed and might make it worse. That's a program for the long haul, which will need to be shaped and modified as we go forward, but is crucial to bring in private investment at competitive yields for this kind of housing for lower income people. We'll, as part of that, we'll need to develop our non-profit organisations very substantially, because most investors will want this housing. They don't want to manage it themselves. They will want people who are experienced at managing this kind of housing. And in most cases, I think that will be non-profit groups. And as has been mentioned earlier, whether they own or manage or both, they form a very large part of the housing picture in other countries. And I think we really need to build that up here. But that, again, will take time. Well, those are the two shorter-term priorities, and just quickly on the longer-term priorities. The first of them, actually, I was delighted to hear, came up towards the end of the morning session, and that is the importance of regional development, development outside our major cities. To take a little bit further the point that David Gruen was discussing, originally the Industry Commission made this point about 7 or 8 years ago, when it looked at about 7 or 8 developed countries and at what proportion of the population in those countries was within what the United Nations calls medium-sized cities, so it's 500,000 to 1 million. In many of those countries, including the United States and Canada and some European countries, the proportion of the population living in those cities is in the 20 to 40% band. In Australia, it's zero. Now, that's a bit of a distortion because we have some cities that are a bit below 500 and some that are a bit above 1 million, so it overstates the difference. But to me, it's fairly obvious, really, that if you have a country that is uniquely, we are a real outlier in the terms of our concentration of our population in the biggest cities. It's actually not just Melbourne and Sydney. If you take Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, we are a real outlier and freak when you compare us with other cities, countries. No other country like us, if you rule out Singapore and United Arab Emirates and some ones like that. Now, that must lead to an excessive competitive pressure on prices in the areas where most of our population lives. And over the longer term, we really need to develop more medium-sized cities. Not greenfield stuff, not cloud cuckoo land, but building on strengths. Reference was made to the Building Better Cities program. I've hardly found anyone who doesn't think that was a very useful program across business and the community sectors. Also, reference was made to Gough Whitlam's initiatives. Over the long haul, they've been successful. Albury Wodonga and Orange Bathurst, which were the two main thrusts, have moved forward. These are not things that can be achieved in the short term. They also, incidentally, don't involve a forced march. At the moment, we artificially suck people into big cities. Our tax system, which I'll come to as my last point, artificially sucks people into big cities and into the best located areas in big cities. It's a distortion in the market, and it's illusory to say that people are choosing in some unalloyed way to live in the big cities. If we really brought market forces to bear by removing those tax distortions, by taxing, by having user charges and congestion charges on vehicles and on pollution, then our structure of cities and our distribution of population would be very different. So it's not correct to analyse our current situation as a market force outcome and an unalloyed choice by individuals. Their choices have been hugely distorted by distortions in the settings that influence them. Part of this development of these cities must be major investment in public infrastructure, and particularly in public transport, and ahead of need. This is so crucial in all initiatives to do with public transport. If you wait for the need to come, it's too late. You must be ahead of need. And this message has been known for centuries but forgotten in the last few decades. Finally, tax reform is probably the most important of all. It may seem, as they say nowadays in the trade, counterintuitive, but we kill home ownership with kindness. I've been saying for 15-odd years that the current systems of exemption from capital gains tax and land tax and other things like the exemption from the pension assets test are not pro-home ownership. They are pro-current home owners. That's a fundamental difference. And one of the justifications, I think, for what I and others have been saying over that time came out in the figures that the ABS released the other day, in a halving in the percentage of first home buyers over the last decade. It's anti-home ownership because it's inflated home ownership. It's inflated house prices. It's people who just want to buy a house to live in competition with people who are seeing it rightly as the best tax minimisation device available to them. I'm not talking for the moment about investors. I'm talking about owner-occupiers, where if you've got a spare $1 million, the best thing to do with a spare $1 million in the last 15-odd years or so, 20 years since capital gains tax exemption came in, has been to buy a home that's worth $1 million more than you need, or renovate it. Now, this is not new. If you look, this problem of having excessively generous tax concessions and the damage they do to an industry, we've seen it over the last 20 years in industries that are smaller and therefore more obvious. Horse breeding, wine growing, the film industry, now managed investment schemes. I'll leave the fourth one out of it because that's still unfolding. But the other three, it's indisputable that they brought those industries to their needs by bringing in money that was driven by tax minimisation motivations and short-term looking for losses rather than long-term productive engagement in the industry. And that's what's happened in the home purchase area. And for those who are keen on home purchase, for those who are in the housing industry, my view is, and has been for well over a decade, that you should be in the forefront of actually restraining these deeply inflationary and unfair tax exemptions. Not extravagantly, a very modest cap on the top, and also by having a trade-off. The current system is upside down and back to front. It's upside down because it's massively generous to the wealthiest people and doesn't help and in fact hinders those who are the worst off. It's back to front because it taxes you when you're trying to get in through stamp duty and then you're home free, literally. I think it would be much better, and many economists support this view, for us to drop or very substantially reduce stamp duty but introduce a land tax or, in fact, cap the land tax exemption. At a high level, only affecting the top end of the market, it will work its way through the market anyway, and on a deferrable basis so that some or all of it you only pay on death or sale. Now, that's a view put by someone much more credible than me, namely the economics editor of the Australian Financial Review. But it's also got increasing support in, again, even more influential circles. The OECD has recognised just most recently in its survey of the United States the deeply distorting and inflationary impact of these things which are thought to be in favour of home purchase, but because they're too generous, in quotes, are actually increasingly having the opposite impact. And the last thing, of course, just moving to investors, is to look at negative gearing. It's silly, I think, to talk about abolishing negative gearing, but we can do what they've done in the United States. Ronald Reagan did it 20 years ago, which is to what's sometimes called quarantining negative gearing so that you can only claim your losses against income from the same area of economic activity, which is perfectly rational and justifiable and doesn't, for example, discriminate against housing compared to some other form of investment. Negative gearing should not be dealt with, in my view, just in relation to housing. That would be unfair. But quarantining would be justifiable. And for those who say the 80s show it didn't work, we said at the time that that wasn't a correct analysis of the experience we're doing it. And again, a much more credible source, Saul Eslake from the ANZ, has recently made exactly the same point after a detailed study, that the often spoken furphy about what happened in the 80s is a furphy, that the main cause of what happened there was not the introduction and then the removal of quarantining of the negative gearing, it was actually changes in the stock market, which of course have a huge impact on whether people rush into or rush out of housing. And the changes in the stock market occurred actually at almost exactly the same time in the US market and then coming over here as our changes in negative gearing. So I think there's a very strong case for quarantining negative gearing in that way, completely compatible with tax principles and would just take some of the edge out of negative gearing. And when you look at what's happened to rental yields, the main reason why rental yields have dropped is because the price that people are having to pay for the housing, the investors have had to pay for the housing, has dropped. It's not that rents have dropped, of course. It's because prices have gone up, and a major factor in that are these tax distortions. So I think in the long term, until we get the intestinal fortitude to address these issues, we can't hope to do much more than some valuable but not profound enough changes in the cost of housing. Thank you.